Today on In Good Faith, we're discussing the legacy of Pope Francis, who died on the 21st of April, 2025. What we're hearing now is audio from the Vatican as the body of Pope Francis is transferred to St. Peter's Basilica. The passing of a pope is news throughout the world, and while his papacy is still current in our minds and before the beginning of the conclave to elect a new pope on May 7th, we want to talk with two of our Catholic friends about the legacy of Pope Francis for the Church as a whole and personally. I am so pleased to have two returning guests who I feel like are friends now because we've gotten to know each other on past episodes. First, Dr. Juliana Borio-Goetz. Julie was our very first guest on episode one of In Good Faith and returned to help lead a discussion on Henry Nouwen's book on spiritual direction, which was so great to have you on that. That's episode 229. She's a retired professor of thermodynamics here at BYU, and she often discusses the intersection of science and faith, navigating mixed faith marriage, and what keeps her connected to God in her everyday life and in her service to her Catholic parish. Julie, what a pleasure. Thank you for coming.
Thanks for the invitation. It's always fun.
Dr. Brandon Peterson is a newer friend and a very recently returning guest. He was most recently on our Holy Week series, talking to us about the meaning and the observance of Good Friday. He's an assistant professor of religious studies at the University of Utah in the Department of World Languages and Cultures, also adjunct in the Department of Philosophy. He's a parishioner at the Cathedral of the Madeleine in Salt Lake City.
Thanks for having me back, Steve.
So you guys are the ones I need to talk to about it, what it means to have the passing of a pope, especially one who has been in that office and serving from March of 2013 till now April 2025. That is a substantial amount of time. And so I want to start with both of you, which I think is an advantage in different generations. I won't say which is which.
That makes me feel a little old there, Steve.
I didn't say you were the... I'm in the same generation.
Better living through chemistry. Went out the window through COVID.
I'd like to ask, when you first knew there was a pope and that it meant something and who it was?
Well, I truly am of a different generation because I remember John the 23rd. I was in grade school when he passed away, but have very fond memories. My family had pictures of him around, as good Catholic families do, and I remember him very, very fondly.
And your family was very active in the church at the time?
Yes. I'm a cradle Catholic. I had an uncle in seminary at the Pontifical College in Ohio during the time of Vatican II, and I had three aunts, great aunts in religious communities. So I grew up with nuns and priests around all the time.
Thank you. And Brandon, how about you?
Yeah, I'm also a cradle Catholic. I grew up in eastern Iowa in Cedar Rapids. And yeah, to your question, I guess the first time I became aware of the Pope was probably when I watched Sister Act as a little kid, and I recognized the white outfit from, there was a portrait of Pope John Paul II in our, the narthex, the entry area to my parish, St. Jude Catholic Church in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And so, yeah, asked questions. Oh, who is this? And so John Paul II was the Pope for a very, very long time. I was born in the 1980s when he was Pope, and he died in 2005 when I was a junior at Notre Dame. And so, yeah, that was my first experience with the passing of a pope and going through the conclave and being aware of that entire process is when I was in college.
Julie, you wrote a very thoughtful piece of, I guess, depending on the font size, a page and a half or 4 pages.
Right, but yeah.
You said these were reflections on the pope you thought of as your pope. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about that.
Well, I too remember the passing of John Paul II. I remember John Paul I for that brief period of time. But Time magazine did a little story in the interim between John Paul II and the election, the next election. And they featured the most prominent folks, but buried in the middle was a story about this cardinal from Argentina who rode the bus to work. Mm. And I, years ago in high school, read Morris West's Shoes of the Fisherman book that talked about a pope that was kind of along those lines. And I thought, man, what would it be like to have a pope who rode the bus to work and ministered to people every day? And so when Cardinal Ratzinger came out, I was still at BYU. The secretaries had called me down. There's white smoke. There's white smoke. Come on down, Julie. Let's see who it is. And when he came out, I admit to turning to them, thanking them and saying, okay, I got to run, and going out into the patio and crying because Ratzinger had not been who I'd been hoping for. But he turned out to be much better, especially during the COVID, when I read many of his encyclicals that I hadn't had time to read before. I'd realized that there was a personal side to him that didn't always come across in the ivory tower academic persona. But then Benedict resigned, and I was somewhat surprised, but okay. When the conclave came, I thought, well, that guy who rode the bus to work from Argentina is probably too old. He's, you know, was passed over. But when they came out on the portico on the balcony up above, and the person, the cardinal announcing the name, said, Jorge, I turned to the secretaries and I said, patience is a virtue, because I knew there were not many others but the name of Jorge. So he came out and took the name Francis, and I just thought it was a perfect fit. So that's why I consider him my pope, because I was rooting for him back before nobody really much knew about his existence.
Thank you. And do you remember, Brandon, also the election of Pope Francis?
Yeah. I wasn't aware of him very much. I'd read through, you know, some of the profiles of potential candidates. But yeah, it was a very different sort of scene than in 2005 when Ratzinger was elected and took the name Benedict. I think a lot of people were familiar with him. I think fewer people were familiar with Francis. I remember at the student center there at Notre Dame when Ratzinger's name was announced, half the room was cheering and half the room was groaning. You know, people knew who he was. But Francis seemed a bit more of a lesser known quantity there. But he's quickly made an impression. And even just that whole scene when he came out on the balcony, I remember, you know, as I was seeing some of the translators, you know, making remarks about this, recognizing, you know, he was making moves very early on. You know, he didn't come out in any sort of fancy apparel. He just had the simple white cassock there. And yeah, the way that he addressed, I mean, he knew the cameras of the world were on him, right? Mm-hmm. But he addressed the church at Rome. What the Pope is the Bishop of Rome, right? One bishop among many bishops, but I mean, he's a very important bishop. But the way he introduced himself was as the Bishop of Rome, which said something about the way he thought of the church. And he would elaborate on this in some of his writings, his teachings, as time went on. But yeah, he certainly made an impression very quickly.
So he felt it was important to show that he had that calling or position as the Bishop of Rome.
Right.
He also sent a sign, because the first thing he did was to say, pray for me.
Yes.
Which was not the usual response of a pope to his new flock. Francis, I think, always had this perspective of the shepherd and the flock as opposed to some exalted position.
Because this is a centuries-long tradition, as I understand it, please correct me, that a pope will choose a different name than they have been living under since they were born and were named. What is the significance of that? And what did that mean to you, for instance, Brandon, when he chose Francis?
Yeah, Francis as a name, I mean, it was a bold name because nobody had taken this before. So Julie mentioned John the 23rd before. There were lots of Johns, you know, and there Paul the 6th was after him. And then you had John Paul combining these two. There's meaning in the names as they're chosen. So John Paul was sort of a bold choice as well. What's that going to mean? But this is a combination of these two prior popes, both of whom were instrumental in a major event in the Catholic world, the Second Vatican Council. So the idea of carrying forward what they were doing, you know, this idea of John Paul, you know, I think was announcing that. What Francis was doing, yeah, he was pointing toward St. Francis of Assisi first and foremost, and an enormously influential figure that struck some new chords in the Catholic world. He was a reformer in some sense. He was, you know, told in having this sort of spiritual experience, you know, looking at this cross of Jesus, you know, he was told, rebuild my church. And he did this literally. He rebuilt a church, you know, but in other senses, he was a reformer that was trying to bring people back to the heart of the gospel message. And so I think a lot of what Pope Francis was doing in choosing that name is signaling that continuity of the reform that started at Vatican II, also drawing on some of the things that we associate with St. Francis. So on Francis's feast day, for instance, at the Cathedral of the Madeleine, there's a blessing of animals that happens. People bring out their pets around the fountain there at the cathedral in Salt Lake City, and there's a blessing of animals that happens. But Francis is associated with care for the wider created world. And Pope Francis, soon after he was elected Pope in 2015, he released an encyclical, which is a teaching document called Laudato Si, or Praised Be, which is referencing a prayer of St. Francis and is on the theme of the care for creation, care for the world. So I think he had some of these themes, some of these ideas in mind as he chose Francis as a title.
And Francis of Assisi was also known for his work among the poor. And so I think Francis, the Pope, Francis I, what do you call it, was also announcing what had been one of his major themes in Argentina, was working with people on the margins, and especially outreach to the poor and the marginalized.
Absolutely.
I would like to dig into in just a moment a little bit more about what it means, for instance, even on a parish level, who the Pope is. But in this case, he was the first Jesuit to become Pope. He was the first from Latin America. And both of you belong to congregations, or the building itself has Spanish-speaking congregations, and the first from the Southern Hemisphere. Would either of you comment on that combination, a first? Does that mean a lot to the faithful from Latin America, for instance?
Well, I'm from a parish called St. Francis of Assisi Parish in Orem. It was named after Francis of Assisi. And so when Jorge Bergoglio took the name Francis, well, all the people in St. Francis were like, this is, you know, good stuff. But certainly for the Latino community, they were thrilled with having someone for whom Spanish was his native language. Mm-hmm. They adopted him wholeheartedly and really, I think, felt some pride in having one of their traditional speakers be the Pope.
Yeah, as far as demographics of the entire Catholic Church are concerned, the places where the Catholic Church is growing the most is in the Southern Hemisphere. Having a leader from that part of the world, I think, is really important. So you mentioned that he's a Jesuit. One Jesuit thinker whose work I study a lot is Karl Rahner. And after the Second Vatican Council in the late 1960s, Rahner wrote a piece where he talked about the Second Vatican Council as marking a sort of shift in ages of the church, going from a Eurocentric church to a truly world church, because at this council you had representatives from all over the world, people who were native to those parts of the world that were there. And so in a way, Francis, who was the first pope who was ordained after the end of the Second Vatican Council, I think you have the realization of this world church idea that Rahner was pointing toward there. And as pope, he's appointed many cardinals, you know, from parts of the world that have never had cardinals before. So at this conclave coming up, we're seeing more of that world church idea that he's representing and pioneering.
Brendan, so much of what happens in any parish or any congregation, I'm thinking of in my own faith, a lot of it where the rubber meets the road is I am sitting next to my neighbor and I kind of know what's going on and hopefully I can be there for them and they for me. And yeah, they might think I'm a little weird, but they love me because they know I have a good heart. I'm assuming all of this, but I feel the same for them. We're all very different, but so much happens on the parish level. Mm-hmm. What filters down from the Pope to that level?
There's a lot of ways that we could talk about this. One immediate way that's been happening in the last few years is Pope Francis's emphasis on synodality. So
these are councils?
It's sort of a fancy term. Synods and councils are words referencing meetings of people, usually bishops. So I mentioned before that he introduced himself as the Bishop of Rome, especially in the 1800s going into the early 1900s. In a lot of ways, the Catholic Church was sort of in a defensive posture, you know, whether it was in the wake of the Protestant Reformation, first of all, but then Enlightenment era, sort of challenges to authority more broadly, politically even, the Papal States are shrinking.
Losing the Papal States.
Yeah. You have this defensive posture. And one reaction to this was an emphasis on the centrality and the authority of the Papal office. And you have titles that are still applied to the Pope, the Vicar of Christ and the Supreme Pontiff and these sorts of ideas. And maybe, you know, one representative teaching would be at the First Vatican Council in the late 1800s, you have the definition of papal infallibility, that the Pope can speak infallibly. In the mid-20th century at Vatican II, this emphasis on the authority vested in the singular figure was complemented by an emphasis on an idea called collegiality, that the bishops all over the world are a teaching body. They're not just simply, you know, yes men to the Pope or something like this, that they teach with their own sort of authority. I mean, there's an emphasis on local teaching, that it's not just a singular sort of figurehead, but the entire church is really a widespread body of Christ. And so by introducing himself as the Bishop of Rome, I think he was emphasizing that idea of collegiality. He's written about how that's an important idea that the Eastern Orthodox Church has maintained and that Catholics can learn from. And he's made strides to help build relations in that way too, by emphasizing collegiality. But synodality is an extension of this idea that applies to not just the College of Bishops, but to the church as a whole. So he implemented a program of having people listen to each other at local parishes. And this is a long way to get back to your question. Listen to each other at local parishes. There are these listening sessions saying, what is the church doing right? What does the church need to do better? And there were these sessions that happened multiple times, and there were representatives that took down notes, and these then went up to higher levels. And so there's a big emphasis on being a listening church that includes the entire body of Christ, not only bishops, not only priests, lay people as well. And so that's one concrete way that a lot of his emphases, his understanding of what the church is, has had an impact. And I heard from all sorts of people at the cathedral that I hadn't heard from before, having these listening sessions, these round tables. It was a really valuable experience.
So can I follow up on just one?
Please.
Just going back, because you've mentioned several times him being the Bishop of Rome.
Yeah.
What I found really helpful was to read the letter that the Bishop of Rome, a.k.a. Francis, wrote to the people of his Diocese of Rome about synodality and what he was expecting, you know, what it was meant to be, why he was doing this. And I found that most people had very little idea of what he meant. And then I said, go read this. It's really helpful. I think, mea culpa, but the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops didn't take it as seriously as they did in a number of places. It was much targeted to particular bishops in their diocese. And so, yes, I think it's a marvelous thing. I think it will be interesting to see if the next pope continues on what had been the extension that Francis had talked about near the end of his life.
Right.
But when done well, when done, religious sisters of women have been doing synodality since Vatican II. There was a document after the end of Vatican II that talked about the reform, the reorganization of religious communities, particularly especially religious women, but not exclusively. They took it very seriously when they have their chapters. They do synodality in practice to come up with the new charisms, the new directions that they want to move in so that everybody has an understanding of where it goes. And I think it's a marvelous way. One of my favorite pictures of the Synod, probably the first one. Francis had appointed Sister Nathalie Becquart from Xavier, missionary sister from France, to be the undersecretary. So like she was the second person in command. And to see these pictures of her sitting at the table with Francis and maybe another woman or two and a cardinal and then some lay men was just the image of synodality for me. It's breaking down the barriers. Francis was very much anti-clerical and getting everybody together, talking, not just talking for the sake of talking, but talking for the sake of listening and for developing relationships so that you knew where the person was coming from when they proposed something and you didn't have just a knee-jerk reaction. Oh, no, that church doesn't teach that. I think that was really important. I'm glad you brought that up, Brennan, because I think that will be one of his legacies. Mm-hmm. For getting us started down that path.
I listened to a podcast, actually you may have pointed me to it, which was with a Jesuit who some say would lean more liberal and the host of this particular show more conservative, but very respectful with each other in their conversations. The thing that this particular Jesuit priest pointed out, Father James Martin, was he said, I'm paraphrasing, people panic sometimes when a subject comes up. But he said the whole point was we should be able to say, can we have a conversation about this? It doesn't mean we're going to change teachings or doctrine or practice, but can we talk about it? And Brendan, you're nodding. Does this seem like that was a change that Pope Francis brought about?
Yeah, I think it was a necessary medicine for an age in particular where we have a lot of divides, where we have a lot of silos and echo chambers where people increasingly live their lives online. I think the pandemic exacerbated this. I don't think this was just a reaction to the pandemic or anything. This was a hallmark. From the very beginning, Francis had this emphasis on a culture of encounter, of interacting with people. But I think it's a perfect theme for the age that we're living in, where there's so many pressures that are forcing us just to talk with people that think like you do, not encounter others, but being able to have those conversations. And some of them are uncomfortable conversations. It's not all, warm, happy, fuzzy feelings. there are people that were pretty animated in the basement of the cathedral there as they're at their tables and talking about different issues. So yeah, they can be tough conversations, but they're important to have. It's when you don't have those conversations and you end up making caricatures of people that are sitting next to you at church, being able to talk to the people who you're praying together with. That's very, very important.
Could I throw in an example of something where I think Francis learned this by experience? So when you look at his time in Argentina, he was a Jesuit. At a very early age, he was the leader of the Jesuit province that covered Argentina and Uruguay, and he was very rigid, and he was not very happy, very pleasant, and he got into political scruffs with the Argentinian governments at various times, including sending a letter to a group of Carmelite nuns when the woman, Christina, I forgot what her last name is, was proposing some same-sex marriage. And Jorge was very, very adamant that this was a sin of the devil. And I mean, very blistering language. And when I read it for the first time, I'm thinking, because then when he became Francis, he encountered people who had been sexually abused by other priests, and one was a gay person. And that person got to be very good friends with him, and they talked about it. And it was over through this talking, I think, through this experience of one-on-one sharing and getting to know, that he opened up his perspective. He never went so far as to change church teaching on gay marriage. But what he did say was, we need to approach each other openly and listen. And then later on, something else I might say, he talks about mercy coming from not just the rules and the regulations, but coming from God's interaction with people.
So I'd love your reaction to what I saw as a non-Catholic, but someone who respects the faith, who respects the position, and came to really respect Pope Francis, were simple things. I don't know if I could call it even simple. It was so dramatic during COVID, during the pandemic, to see him go out all by himself because there were no gatherings. Do you want to tell me about this event where he was there all alone on this empty plaza? And it was a prayer and a service. And I wonder if you'd talk about that.
Yeah.
Because this is just etched in my heart. It was so striking.
It still is in my heart.
Yeah. The image there, when so many people have been isolating, you know, with their families, or maybe if, you know, a single person that's not living with a family, a roommate, or maybe even by yourself, right? It can be it was for many of us a really lonely sort of time and a fearful time, right? Where we didn't know what was going to be happening next. We saw, you know, all these reports of hospitals that were filled to the brim, and Italy in particular was suffering enormously. And you read these awful stories of people who were dying alone. And so I think it was a time of great fear. But Francis, this image where he's there, if I'm remembering correctly, he had a monstrance, right?
That was later? Yeah.
Okay.
So in the beginning, one always often thinks of John Paul II as being the theatrical pope because he had been in drama groups and he'd done plays. But this struck me as I think spontaneously from Francis, but revealed his understanding of the power of images. And so the plaza outside of St. Peter's was totally bare. It had been raining. Mm-hmm. And so the lights were flickering off the puddles of water. And he walks across. His former assistant from Benedict was up there on the platform for him, but he walked up across the entire plaza, walked up the stairs by himself, and there was just this light on him. And what struck me was the image of, he's sending the message to all of us, I know what it's like to be alone. I know that you're alone. We're alone, but we're all in this together. And then it was after he gave the Urbi et Orbi, to the city and the world address, that then he went further up where there were some cardinals and other people inside the portico. And then he had a Eucharistic adoration, a blessing with the monstrance. But that was near the tail end of things.
Yeah. No, that's...
And so that's when he's bringing out the consecrated host.
Yes.
Right. So yeah, one element, the consecration of Eucharistic species, the bread and wine, is at the center of the Catholic Mass, but then there's a devotional practice that's kind of an extension of the Mass where the consecrated host, which Catholics understand to be Jesus himself, sacramentally present, is there. And so I think in that time of loneliness, to have, you know, him sort of boldly going forth in this rainy, dreary, you know, sort of setting, I think that gave people heart. But then one of the themes that I think is important to remember in Francis's papacy, which was controversial in many ways, especially in the U.S. church, is that it was traditional in a lot of ways, too, that everything he was doing was pointing us back toward Jesus again and again and again. And that in particular, you know, in the midst of all of that loneliness, ultimately pointing us toward Jesus. We're not alone. We have a God that's near to us, that incarnates, that's here in our midst in the messiness and the loneliness and the ugliness of many different human situations.
And even the larger set design, to use a theatrical term, behind where his podium was a really beautiful but very simple crucified Christ hanging. Mm-hmm. And at one point he went back and kissed the feet, traditional mm-hmm. Lent, and we were in the middle of Lent. And then over on the other side was, I believe, the icon from Maria Maggiore, the basilica where he is entombed. Those were the only two things there that broke the starkness of the platform where he was. And he went to both of them and reverenced them quietly. I think, again, making that connection to our humanity and our faith, the principles of our faith of Christ and his loving mother, Mary. And
in happier times and more public times, I was also struck by his willingness, not just willingness, but it seemed like his drive to reach out to people. And there are some famous moments of someone who was actually quite disfigured, for instance, with a skin disease that he just grabbed and embraced. And you might think, of course, we want to show love to this person, but is that even safe? And it seemed like that was just not even in his main thinking. Here was just someone to embrace in a difficult situation. And washing feet in prisons rather than other church officials, for instance, which was another option.
And another break. I mean, he was, I think, the first one to go outside of a formal church to do the washing of the feet. And the fact that he had non-Catholics, he had women, young women, and in some cases, also was for folks who sometimes use the term liturgical Nazis or liturgical geeks. These are the traditions, and we've got to honor them, and there's mm-hmm. certain symbolisms. I think that's partly what got some people's hackles up, because it was more about reaching the people where the people are, and not standing on formalities or long-standing traditions that weren't mandated.
Isn't that a phrase he used to mm-hmm. meet people where
yes,
they are?
Yes, it is, very much
that's
so.
That's his own.
Yeah, that culture of encounter, again, I think that's a hallmark of his papacy that he'll be remembered for, is the close embraces, whether that's on Holy Thursday with the washing of the feet, or, I mean, the scene that you talked about. I remember this and thinking to myself, I mean, this is Francis of Assisi. One of the many things he was known for was, not only care for animals and all these other things, but also his encounters with people suffering from leprosy and that proximity that he had. And one story that stuck with me, it's been, so a lot of my own friends on social media are, from grad school and are theological geeks like me, and it's been kind of fun seeing their own retrospectives over the past week as they've thought about Francis. But one of my friends from grad school posted this YouTube video that I hadn't seen before, but it's from 2018, where Francis was meeting with a number of school children outside of Rome, and there was a little boy who came forward. They're asking him questions, and it's just this really touching scene. I'd encourage people to look this up on YouTube. It's easy to find. But
I actually have the dialogue from it. Can I read it?
Yes, please.
Yeah,
because you have the words themselves.
America Magazine has a clip of it with subtitles, and if you search America Magazine and Francis and Emmanuel, Emanuele, I'm sure you'll find it. So he, as you say, he was visiting a poor parish on the outskirts of Rome, and this young boy gets brought up. He's reluctant to speak. He gets brought up by one of the priests, and Francis is calling him out, come, Vene. He asks Francis if his father, who has died, and he's a non-believer, was in heaven. Francis doesn't give him a simple yes or no answer. And I think this is really an instructive in how Francis approached theology, the reality of people and the theology. And so he says to the group of people, the larger, is dad in heaven? His father wasn't a believer, but he had his children baptized. He had a good heart. The one who says, who goes to heaven, is God. But what is God's heart like with a dad like that? He invites the crowd to respond to his questions. What do you think? He waits for them to answer. And then he says, responds to their answers, a father's heart, God has a dad's heart. And a dad who was not a believer, but who baptized his children. Do you think God would be able to leave him far from himself? Making gestures of casting out, and then shaking his head. No, God wouldn't do that. Does God abandon his children? Does God abandon his children when they are good? And the crowd responds, no. And he turns to the little boy and he says, there, Emmanuel, There is your answer. God surely was proud of your father because it is easier as a believer to baptize your children than to baptize them when you are not a believer. Surely this pleased God very much. Talk to your dad. Pray for your dad. That's the end of the... And to me, that really spoke worlds to how he saw what some people saw as the too much mercy and not enough theology, that he saw that mercy was at the underlying of everything, from the Good Samaritan to the prodigal son in the scriptures, that mercy was important. And it wasn't just solely making decisions on the basis of rules and regulations, but that you had to work with the people. And I think where his experience in meeting the gay person after he, in Argentina, had roundly very negative about them, that he himself begun to experience what happens when you get to meet people where they are and you look at them with the mercy that God looks at them.
Yeah, the whole scene where this little boy is at the microphone and trying to, but you can just tell there's this enormous pain in his heart. I mean, his father has recently died, and Francis's reaction to this, you know, just saying, "Come to me, come to me," and the boy yeah. comes up and just collapses into his shoulder, and you can see Francis's hand there, and his ring is visible in the shot that they have, and it's just on the back of his head as this boy is just sobbing into his shoulder, and he's whispering, and just that intimacy, that closeness, it was just incredibly powerful. And yeah, the way that he navigated the questions, I was impressed by as well. But ongoing theme, God's nearness, over and over again, as we have a God that's persistent in his love for us. And like the father in the story of the prodigal son, which might be better titled The Merciful Father, right?
Exactly.
You know, that he's,
yes.
you know, persistently, you know, open and inviting and looking for a way into our lives.
Yeah, I've heard people say sometimes we're focusing on the wrong son in that story, so we could all do a little better as well.
Yes, and I always relate with the older son. I mean, mea culpa, but...
right. So this is an impossible question, but if you were made pope...
It is impossible for me.
The whole idea that sometimes people in the conclave might think we know how someone will be because of this is their past practice or these are their past writings. And then we've mentioned two different examples of people who were at least seemed to be one way. And then both with Benedict and with Pope Francis. What is that? Is it that responsibility, that mantle that suddenly... It's a different filter of, I'm looking for what that understanding, would you be the same person? Could you be when you're suddenly given a responsibility like that?
Yeah, I think we see, I won't even touch the question of what I would be. but historically, I think you do see lots of unexpected things happen when people become Pope. So I mentioned before the teaching of papal infallibility, you know, in the late 1800s. So one of my professors in grad school who was, you know, in seminary in the 1950s said that the expectation at that point was that there weren't going to be any other councils. Councils are usually called when there's some emergency that happens and you need to gather all of the bishops to make a decision. But now the Vatican Council I is what we call it now. But just at that point, the Vatican Council had convened and had recognized this ability of the Pope to be able to speak infallibly. So if there's an emergency, why have a council? You have a Pope that can speak infallibly, right? And so there in 1958, 1959, after Pius the 12th dies, after a very long papacy, you have a conclave where the participants are sworn to secrecy, but somehow, you know, things end up leaking out in Italy. and you get reports of what's all happening. But you even know from the length of time that there was a deadlock that was happening. Mm. People, they weren't able to decide. They weren't able to reach a consensus, you know, or at least a critical mass to be able to move forward. And so you had the election of the man who becomes John the 23rd, who is fairly advanced in age. And one thing that happens in these sorts of arrangements is if you have a deadlock, you know, sometimes you find a compromise candidate, maybe somebody who's not going to have a super long, you know, 25-year papacy. So they elect John the 23rd. Some people described him at the time as having expectations that he would be a caretaker pope.
Mm-hmm. Placekeeper.
Yeah. he'll kind of keep things running for the next few years until the next conclave where they'll decide. And within months, he announces that he's convening an ecumenical council. And that's how we get Vatican II. And I think this took people totally by surprise. So yeah, you I think it's important. I mean, as we're looking forward to the conclave coming up, nobody ever knows who's going to come out of the conclave. But even after somebody's elected, you don't really know what's in store and what direction they have, what way the Holy Spirit's operating in the church and where things are going to be headed.
Okay, last I read, over a billion Catholics in the world. And this election of a new pope, hugely important. And I find myself, first of all, having been really kind of, I don't know if it's the right word, but enchanted by Pope Francis, even whether I agreed or not, just the person he seemed to be was frankly the kind of person I want to be. And so I find myself hoping for a pope, though I'm not Catholic, and thinking, well, there's nothing wrong with me praying for the conclave and the bishops to receive and the Holy Spirit to speak. And I'm really grateful that you two are so generous to interrupt your day on short notice, your time, and come in this week and share those personal thoughts. And anything you'd like to end with about the papacy of Pope Francis or about moving forward?
Yeah, I'll reflect a little bit on ways that he's really impacted me personally. I spoke about the culture of encounter before. So I was born during John Paul II's papacy, and that was my entire time through childhood and going into college was John Paul II, who was himself an academic, and his successor, Benedict, was also an academic. And here I am, I've gone into academia myself, right? So in a certain sense, there's a lot that I like about, you know, when I read John Paul II and Benedict XVI, because they're very heady, they're very theological. You know, I there's a lot of rich stuff that's in there. But Francis really challenged me as, I mean, to be clear, he has a really rich theology himself. He's not a theological slouch. He knows what he's talking about, and I've learned a lot from him.
I think the Jesuits make sure of that.
Yeah,
exactly.
But his background is different. You know, he was Pope as a pastor, and the way that he taught and lived out this idea of encounter was one that really challenged me to think, you know, spiritually, when I think myself, okay, how am I going to think about my own identity as a Christian or my own relationship with God. He pointed toward how you find God in other people and going to people that are on the margins, that are lonely, and reaching out to them. He said, it's not just about what you do in your head. It's about what you do with your hands, with your feet. So when I was in grad school, I mean, one of the ways that he sort of challenged my family at that point. I was thinking, okay, I'm spending all of this time reading all of these theology books, but what am I doing, you know, to be able to meet with people? So our family started visiting a senior care facility that was there, and we had a couple of small children at that point, like one and three, and our thinking with this was, okay, bring some life and some energy and some cute little kids that people can, you know, interact with. And sometimes that went well. Other times it was, you know, it created all sorts of havoc. But yeah, I think he really challenged a lot of people to say, what are you doing on the ground to see the face of Christ in other people? That spirit of dialogue that extended into the idea of synodality, of service, it's something that's a continual challenge that I think has really enriched a lot of Christian spirituality around the world.
Thank you.
To go back to his early days, before he was a Jesuit, he was trained as a chemical technician. And with my background as a chemist, I immediately was engaged with the idea of this person who knows some science. And then he took on the name Francis. And Francis, as we've already given an indication, was very much committed. Laudato Si is the canticle of creation. And it's a praise. It was the basis from which Francis' encyclical takes its name, Laudato Si, of care for our creation. And I read it really carefully. And again, I don't think it got the coverage and care that it should have in many places in the United States. But it is good theology. It is good anthropology. It is good sociology in terms of how do you go about, if you're going to do redevelopment work, you don't bring in Manhattan executives. You pay attention to the people who are on the ground, who know the culture, who know the botany. But the science, I was teaching Physical Science 100 at BYU at the time, and climate science was part of what was in the curriculum. And so I was somewhat familiar with what the climate science folks said needed to happen. And Laudato Si had that very, a kernel of really accurate science, not only accurate in terms of bringing people together, but in terms of how the science had to play. And then on a completely different dimension, Pope Francis, Jorge, took the name Francis. And we Catholics sometimes talk about our spirituality in terms of the directions we like to go. And because of Francis's focus with nature and my science background, I very much resonated with Pope Francis. And then when I came to Provo and found out that the parish was St. Francis of Assisi, I thought, oh, the Lord brought me here for a reason. You know, this is a good decision. But then Bergoglio brought the Jesuit dimension of God in all things, ad majorem Dei gloriam, all for the honor and glory of God, and that you see God in the people around you, you see God in nature. And when we were in the middle of COVID, my husband and I would walk up Provo Canyon, and I would look at the rocks, and you know, as you go up the canyon, you see different variations of rocks, and I think, oh yeah, there's the slate obeying God's internal law because of the underlying molecular structure, a crystal structure, you know. They have certain fracture patterns, and you'd go a little higher up, and then you'd see the coming down, you'd see the sun flickering on the little waves in the river, in the Provo River, and thinking, God is there. I miss my Eucharist, but God didn't leave us alone. He is there. And yes, so I'm going to miss the guy.
I will too. He had such a profound impact. And you mentioned Laudato Si. One of the other things that I thought was so brilliant was that he wasn't just talking about the need for, he drew attention to climate change, you know, which was very important, other aspects of ways that humans have been degrading our common home, the environment, but he connected this back to the poor also, that the cry of the earth is the cry of the poor. The people that are going to be impacted the most by these issues are people that aren't of means, that can't find, you know, use money to create a buffer between here. And the emphasis on throwaway culture, I'm hoping that this is a continued theme that we see, that he lamented that so much of our culture, driven by consumerism, driven by this unfettered need to produce and, you know, and consume, that this leads to
endless growth. Yeah. It's always got to be more and more. Mm-hmm.
Right, right. That this leads to discarding goods, but also discarding people. That people are discarded, and we get used to using things and using people, and that this is poisonous. And he does this in ways that I think cut across political divides. It's some people portray him as, oh, he's the liberal pope or the left pope, and through an American political lens, he doesn't fit these sorts of things at all. I mean, and in Laudato Si, on the one hand, he'll challenge capitalism and, you know, these sorts of things on the one hand, and then he'll turn around and say people that are discarded. This includes the elderly. We shouldn't be discarding of the elderly through aid in dying or euthanasia sort of laws. We shouldn't be discarding unborn humans. He cuts through a lot of the nice and tidy boxes that we tend to think through in the American political culture. So he challenges those. But the emphasis of avoiding a throwaway culture, of recognizing the dignity of every human being, finding God in all things and all people, that I'm hoping is an enduring legacy of his.
That's a very beautiful place to end on, with Julie Burrio-Goetz and Brandon Peterson, both cradle Catholics, both also academics, and I think something you had in common with Pope Francis.
Yep.
Thank you so much for teaching us and sharing today on In Good Faith.
It's been a wonderful conversation.
Yes, thank you very much. I enjoy it.
I'm so grateful to Julie Burrio-Goetz and Brandon Peterson for generously sharing their faith and their thoughts today. I hope you'll sign up for our In Good Faith newsletter at ingoodfaithpodcast.org, and you can email us at ingoodfaith@byu.edu. We always love to hear from our listeners. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, wherever you get your podcasts, and we hope you leave a comment and a 5-star review to help spread the word. In Good Faith is a production of BYU Radio. I'm Stephen Cap Perry. I hope you'll join me again soon, right here, In Good Faith.